This is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly magazine about New York State government and politics. Your host is David Gustina, with political commentary by Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.
Coming up this week, our political observer Alan Chartok on what looks like a budget that will be passed on time by the April 1st deadline. A myriad of groups advocate for their funding needs, including those that want funding for Lyme disease. And we look deeper into the issue of sports gambling in New York. Those stories and more on the Legislative Gazette. Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok. Well, the state budget in New York has to be in place on Sunday in order to start the new fiscal year, April 1st, Alan. And it looks like, at least according to the Assembly Speaker, our Karen DeWitt is reporting, that the budget is more than likely going to be done. The lawmakers say agreements have been reached, and among other things, to give a sizable increase in state aid to public schools, ban single-use plastic bags while imposing a fee on paper bags, and reject a plan by Governor Cuomo to make Election Day a state holiday.
Well, these are always tough negotiations. Cuomo himself has had a rough ride with the New York State Senate and the newly elected majority there. That's why a lot of us think and have always thought that he wanted to keep the Republicans in power, because they became the drag on the system and he didn't have to do the hard work. Now we see an incredible dispute between the governor's press guy, who used to be my student, I should say, by way of disclosure, and uses a dirty word describing a couple of the Democratic senators and raising the tension level. We know that there's no need, some of us practice it, but there's no need for public profanity. It is probably not a great idea, although tempers do grow short, that's for sure.
And the argument there was over public campaign financing and the fact that the Times had reported on a secretive dinner that Cuomo had $25,000 ahead. We talked about this yesterday, and they shot back basically saying these lawmakers are hypocrites. They're having their fundraisers, too.
Well, they are. They're not asking for $25,000 a ticket, but they are. It doesn't much matter whether it's $500 or whether it's $25,000. The system is corrupt. We all know that when people give money, they want something. That's the way it is. You can say, oh, yeah, well, what they want is a pure democracy. Forget about it. The people who have the most, at least one of the people who is giving the money to the Cuomo campaign said, well, I do what my lobbyist tells me. Well, that's not good. The governor has railed against this kind of thing. Now it's up to him to show leadership here.
Well, the state of New York, the Attorney General, Letitia James, held a news conference yesterday. She has announced that the state has laid out one of the most detailed legal cases yet against the owners of Purdue Pharma, the makers of the opioid OxyContin, and distributors claiming systematic fraud.
Well, I tell you, we are going through an opioid scandal in this country. And a lot of people, we are told, have become addicted to the stuff. It is time for everybody to take stock. Bring your stuff to the police station or to other places which receive it. I'm always troubled by the fact that the police won't give you a receipt when you bring it, at least in my hometown, at least when I've tried. Because I want to make sure I know whether that stuff is being tracked in the system. But in any case, it is a very serious problem. The state of New York has a lawsuit there. You know, these pharma companies can be unpopular, and I hope that they will be brought up short to be even more responsible than they say they are being right now. But we'll see. We'll see whether these cases get legs.
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok.
Thank you.
are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. With New York State budget negotiations ratcheting up in the final days before the deadline, a myriad of groups are advocating for their funding needs, including advocates who want money for combating Lyme disease. The Legislative Gazette's Allison Dunn reports.
The Senate budget proposal includes $1 million for Lyme and tick-borne disease initiatives. Hyde Park Republican Sue Serino, who chairs the Senate's Task Force on Lyme and Tick-Borne Diseases, says since taking office, she has successfully fought for funding to be included in the final state budget after it was repeatedly left out of the executive proposal.
And last year, we were able to get $1 million, which was amazing. And it's, like the Kerry Institute, when we give them $190,000, and that's not a lot of money, but they do so much for research and education and prevention.
Last year's $1 million allocation was unprecedented in the state budget. Dr. Rick Ostfeld is a disease ecologist with the Millbrook-based Cary Institute of Ecosystem Studies. He says it's a struggle without the funding.
Well, it becomes quite a hardship for those of us who are working to better protect the public health against tick-borne disease. You know, New York State has the second highest number of cases of tick-borne disease in the U.S. We are a hotbed. There's been a clear spread in the distribution of Lyme disease and other tick-borne diseases throughout virtually the entire state, with the possible exception of the High Peaks area in the Adirondacks. But even with climate change, the ticks are moving up in elevation. So there will soon be no part of the state that is untouched by tick-borne disease. And the money funds the research to understand where that risk comes from, to ameliorate it, to try to reduce our probability of getting exposed, to educate our population, to work on better diagnostic and preventative and treatment measures. And all those would suffer if we don't have funding in this year's budget.
Ostfeld is working on the TICK Project, a five-year study with Bard College that runs through 2021 and focuses on households throughout Dutchess County with tick-killing interventions. Serino's 41st district includes a large portion of Dutchess and part of Putnam County.
And I don't care who you ask, everybody knows somebody that's had Lyme disease, and some much sicker than others, you know, and young children. It's horrible.
We do not want to get to the point where people don't want to come visit our parks and outdoor spaces because they're worried about Lyme and tick-borne disease.
That's Democratic Assemblymember Dee Dee Barrett, who has long been an advocate for Lyme disease awareness and improved treatment. Barrett represents portions of Dutchess and Columbia counties.
It's really important that we address this both from the health standpoint and the environmental standpoint, and I hope that the governor will recognize that. I think, my colleagues in the Assembly understand this, and, I trust that they will continue to be supportive in the ways that we can, but we really want the governor's leadership on this as well.
The Cary Institute's Ostfeld says receiving funding is difficult outside of the state, and supplementing any federal funding advances the science.
The important thing to note is that largely funding for this kind of research, disease, tick-borne disease, environmental risks and things, comes from federal agencies, and they are continually strapped, and I think it is widely recognized in many circles that the federal agencies are not providing sufficient funds for tick-borne disease research. I think that is in part because it is not perceived as being a national problem when it is, in a sense. I mean, it's a very widespread problem, but there are parts of the country where risk is very low and disease incidence is low.
In June, Governor Andrew Cuomo called Lyme and tick-borne disease one of the most pressing public health issues of our time. He said this while announcing a public-private research collaboration to advance the diagnosis and treatment of tick-borne diseases with the State Department of Health Wadsworth Center Laboratory and biotech company Regeneron Pharmaceuticals. Meantime, legislation Barrett authored took effect in February, requiring signs informing visitors of the dangers of Lyme disease and tick-borne diseases be installed at state parks, trail entryways, and campgrounds.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Allison Dunn.
Alan, what do you make of this measles outbreak in Rockland County? It's prompted a state of emergency, and it says anyone who's under 18 years of age and unvaccinated against the measles will be barred from public places for a month.
David, the Kool-Aid here has been given to some people who have accepted this clear lie about vaccinations. Look, it's going to take some real courage because there are people who really believe in this stuff. And, you know, they have accepted the fact that their children shouldn't be vaccinated, putting everybody else at risk. This is where we need a public health bureaucracy that will take no prisoners and do what is right. Look, you got an outbreak. I heard that something like 85% of the people who have the measles were not vaccinated. Surprise! I may have that 80% a little bit wrong, but I don't think so. So the public health officials are doing what they have to do. Hey, we gave it to our kids. I believe in it, and I feel badly for the people who have accepted what is clearly bad science.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Meanwhile, as the negotiations continue over the New York State budget, unions and many Democrats in the state legislature are pushing for an expansion of the state's prevailing wage law, but they're finding that the change might have some unintended consequences. We get more from the Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt.
We're going to fight like hell to make sure that this is in the budget.
Assemblyman Harry Bronson is the sponsor of a bill to extend prevailing wage rules to projects that draw from private and public government funds. He was joined by around 200 construction workers. They stood on the Capitol's ornate million-dollar staircase between the Senate and Assembly chambers. The workers say the change would add significantly to their pay. In a hallway on the other side of the Senate were proponents of public campaign financing, additional taxes on the richest New Yorkers, and more spending on the state's poorest schools. Janine Harper is the head of the PTA at PS 770 in Brooklyn. She says her school is owed $500,000 in funding under a 12-year-old court order known as the Campaign for Fiscal Equity. She says it's remained unfulfilled to this day.
The funding for the schools is in the budget. And we're just counting on Governor Cuomo to make sure that it actually gets passed. And like, there seems to be some discrepancy where he's not wanting to fund it as much as it should be. And I don't understand what the reason is, because like, our kids deserve the money that like his kids get when they go to private schools.
Governor Cuomo, who's proposed spending an additional $1 billion more on schools in the new budget, has said it's time to move on from the court case. The legislature wants to fulfill the court order in a three-year phase-in. It recommends spending $600 million more on schools this year above the governor's number.
Thank you, Linda, and it's great to be here.
Others are pressing to keep some measures out of the budget, including a tax proposed by Cuomo on opioid prescriptions. Opponents include the chair of the Assembly Health Committee and the legislature's only pharmacist, Assemblyman John McDonald. He says it's terrible public policy.
We all know there's an opioid crisis. We all know there's plenty of fingers to point and many entities that people want to villainize. But at the end of the day, pharmacies aren't the villain. And patients certainly are not the villain in this situation. And therefore, I believe firmly that this opioid tax should be jettisoned out of the state budget.
McDonald and others say the latest version of the bill, which was first proposed by Cuomo last year, is badly flawed. The 2018 bill would have prohibited drug companies from passing the costs on to patients, but that provision was struck down in federal court as unconstitutional. The new version does not prevent manufacturers from raising prices for patients. Julie Farrar, who has chronic pain from a spinal condition, worries that her medical bills might go up if the tax is approved.
Is going to trickle down in a way that is going to hurt the people that use opioids effectively to manage, for myself, chronic severe pain.
The tax would bring in $100 million to the state's general fund. Assemblyman McDonald says the money could instead be gained from savings in the state's vast Medicaid program. The biggest group of the day included several hundred developmentally disabled New Yorkers and their health aides asking for a cost of living pay increase for the direct care workers. Governor Cuomo took the funding out of his budget this year. Senate Mental Health Committee Chair David Carlucci, who addressed the crowd, says the Senate proposes restoring it.
It's about priorities. And what can be a better priority than taking care and providing a living wage to those that provide care to our most vulnerable populations?
Later, the governor's top counsel, Alfonso David, said that Cuomo had changed his mind.
The governor has made a decision that he will not pass a budget without increasing the wages for direct care workers.
It's one of several changes likely to occur before the budget deadline. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
The first two rounds of the NCAA tournament are now in the books, and the American Gaming Association estimates fans across the country will wager billions on March Madness, but not in New York State, at least not legally. The Legislative Gazette's Jesse King with more.
Well, this is not your typical 4-13 matchup. UC Irvine, the hottest team in the field.
The American Gaming Association says about 47 million people across the country will wager $8.5 billion on March Madness. AGA President Bill Miller says that's more than twice the amount fans wagered on the Super Bowl.
In fact, 30 million more Americans will bet on March Madness than attended a professional football game last year.
Also notable in the AGA's poll is how fans will be betting. Despite a 2018 U.S. Supreme Court decision allowing states to legalize sports betting, Miller says 2.4 million Americans will illegally bet on March Madness with a bookie, while another 5.2 million turn to illegal offshore websites.
A large percentage of Americans don't even know the legal status of sports wagering in their jurisdiction. So all of us engaged in this effort need to continue to work together to ensure that bettors know how and where to do this legally.
Since the decision in 2018, seven states have joined Nevada in legalizing sports betting, and online gambling sites and mobile apps have gained popularity. New York, however, is not among them. Speaking with WAMC's Alan Shartok, Governor Andrew Cuomo said he wasn't a fan of mobile betting and didn't see an economic benefit to legalization.
New Jersey has sports betting. They have it. It's on TV all the time. You can't turn on the darn TV without seeing it. They raised something like $13 million. $13 million is a rounding error in our state. I don't even think the economic benefit is there.
That's not to say the effort isn't there. The New York State Gaming Commission posted rules last week that could allow in-person sports betting at upstate on-site casino lounges by the summer, even if the legislature doesn't pass a comprehensive bill. AGA President Miller says sports betting legalization is the future.
I think there's a reason that we've gone from one state to eight, and with 20-some states that have different variations of sports betting legislation in those states, because they believe, number one, their constituents want it, and number two, there is significant revenue for the state to benefit.
Miller says legalization could bring a younger, more diverse demographic to casinos and dismissed Governor Cuomo's economic reasoning. The point, he argues, is to bring illegal bettors into a regulated environment.
From a fundamental perspective, safe, legal, better than illegal and unsafe, and state revenue versus no state revenue, better than no state revenue.
A February Siena poll found New Yorkers split on the matter, with 44% supporting and 44% opposing. Michelle Haddon, assistant executive director of the New York Council on Problem Gambling, says the group is concerned how legalization may affect those struggling with gambling addiction.
We know from research that the more that we see an increase in opportunities and accessibility, that the more likely we are to see, subsequent consequences related. And we, are looking at how are we going to, work as a state to mitigate, the potential consequences that are going to come from that expansion.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Jesse King.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. A rail disaster in Quebec in 2013 touched off international concern about the safety of so-called oil trains that haul crude oil from fields to refineries and ports across North America, including Albany. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas reports a Canadian author and activist says that while the media attention has waned, the danger, including in Albany, is as great as ever.
In July 2013, a runaway crude oil train from North Dakota derailed and exploded in Lac-Mégantic, Quebec, killing 47. Regulators said 72 tanker cars had been misclassified as posing a low risk. The incident made headlines worldwide and sent officials scrambling to appease public concerns about rail safety. oil trains became a buzzword for activists and politicians, from New York U.S. Senator Chuck Schumer to newly minted Albany Common Councilor Dorsey Appleers. 6 years and innumerable pages of legislation later, tankers still pass and park dangerously close to Ezra Prentice Homes, a 179-unit apartment complex in Albany's South End. Bruce Campbell, author of The Lac-Megantic Rail Disaster, Public Betrayal, Justice Denied, spoke Wednesday in Albany at an event sponsored by Save the Pine Bush.
It was important for me to tell the entire story because memories tend to fade and people forget what happened and why it happened and who was responsible. And so I've encapsulated that in a book, and I don't want it to happen anywhere else. If I can tell that story, and it will lead to actions which prevent history from repeating itself, then I think I will have done what I intended to do.
Campbell is personally acquainted with many of the Lac-Megantic residents and blames the tragedy on regulatory failure, negligence, and corporate criminality.
No one has been held accountable. There were three frontline workers that were tried and were acquitted. None of the people that were responsible has been held accountable. So that's where the subtitle, Justice Denied. There's so many unanswered questions, and there is a need for justice. There's been no public inquiry.
The Canadian press reported 37 of 110 improved, upgraded oil tankers spilled crude in February in western Manitoba after derailing on farmland. Although the U.S. government has tightened regulations on oil tankers, Campbell has concerns about Albany.
Oil by rail is on the rise again. Record volumes of oil by rail exports, certainly from Canada. They're still coming from the Bakken region, fracked oil from Bakken. I don't have the power to stop it. So if I can do anything is to do what I can to ensure that it happens as safely as possible. They should be looking at ways to bypass major population centers. That has happened in Lac-Megantic, where the worst rail disaster, certainly in Canadian history, happened, and it has to be the case in other urban centers as well.
Former Albany Common Councilor and South End activist Dom Calcellaro warns that danger stems from lax regulation.
There's no oversight. It was the same thing that's happened here, and it's happening even more now under the Trump administration. You see with the airlines, with the, you know, with the 737s, they keep taking regulations off, and we didn't have enough. Same thing was going on here. We allow the railroads to, you know, check the rails themselves, you know, tell us how volatile the fluids are, the gasoline or the oil, the petroleum products that they're shipping, and for the Lac-Megantic, they lied. They actually had the wrong number on there. It was actually much more volatile. Petroleum product and what they even listed on the tank cars. We really have to keep up on this.
In January, the U.S. Department of Transportation rescinded a 2015 order regarding the safety of trains that haul volatile materials. Calcellaro worries about city residents who live near the tracks.
At Albany today, we're not getting the crude oil trains we're getting. But every day we have unit trains, 180 to 120 cars, of ethanol going through downtown Albany. And ethanol might just be as bad, if not worse, than the crude oil. And this kind, and they're brushing that off, well, it's ethanol, so it's okay. But it's not okay. And who's regulating that? Who's watching the amount of ethanol they're getting? And again, it's coming through downtown Albany, the park downtown, the trains. They're leaving the empty cars still parked behind Ezra Prentice. Like they were before.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. For copies, call 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 1913. Or just listen or podcast on the web at wamc.org. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina. Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign.
and United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.